from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. You've heard about adult children conceived with donor sperm who might want to track down their biological roots, find the donor. There's now a new trend, tracking down your so-called diblings, half-siblings from the same sperm donor. And parents are doing the tracking, sometimes from the moment of conception. This hour on Point, donor sibling networks in the digital age. Join us. Are you a parent of a child conceived with donor sperm? Have you made contact with other parents who share the same donor? Have you found your diblings? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Joining me first from New York City is Ashley Fetters, staff writer for The Atlantic. Her story published on Tuesday was headlined, "The Changing Norms Around Donor Sibling Networks." You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Great to have you with us, Ashley.
Hi, Jane. It's great to be here with you.
Thank you. So sperm donation is increasingly popular. Tell me about this new trend toward transparency.
Sure. So sperm donation has been a lot like adoption in America, where for many generations, it was something that was a, kind of a one-time transaction that you never really talked about again, or maybe never talked about in public. Parents didn't tell their friends, kids didn't usually meet their biological families, and most donors stayed anonymous forever. But for a number of reasons, many families have started to favor more transparency. More parents are upfront about their decision to conceive through donor sperm. Mm-hmm. And more donors are open to releasing some biographical details or being contacted by their offspring later in life. So it's definitely changing.
So as you say, this was once a sort of niche practice. How many babies mm-hmm. now are born in the United States conceived through sperm donation?
So the statistics there are a little bit hard to come by. Some of the most reliable ones, though, that that I've come across in my own research are from 2010. And that year, out of 4 million births, 4 million babies born that year, some 30 to 60,000 of them were donor conceived, mm-hmm. which comes out to about, you know, a little less or a little more than 1%. Mm. So it's still, you know, pretty, it's like it's relatively uncommon compared to the rest of the ways that we, the ways that we have kids. Mm-hmm. But I would note this too, that in the time since then, we've also, come around to same-sex marriage being federally recognized and legally protected. So I think that has also helped to normalize and probably, you know, anecdotally, it seems like that has helped make it at least seem more common.
So tell me about the term dibbling.
Dibbling. It's a cute one, isn't it?
Indeed.
It is, right?
Yes. Donor and sibling, right? I guess that's the combination.
Yeah. It's a cute little portmanteau. So it's come about, I think, at the same time as a lot of other terminology around sperm donation. I mean, I think some people bristle at the notion of sister or brother or child or parent because, you know, some of these kids have sisters, brothers, mm-hmm. children, and parents mm-hmm. who are not their donor or not their genetic relatives. So I think some families have adopted these terms to sort of create some differentiation or some distance, if you will, between what's actual family and what's genetics.
Here's a clip from a woman, a 21-year-old woman in Orlando, Keanu Aurora. She's on a mission to track down her 46 diblings. They're scattered across the globe. She's met 20 so far, and here she talks about why she wants to meet more of them, in particular the girls.
Siblings are the best thing that I can ever have. Being able to feel like a big sister to them just made me want to be a big sister to all the rest of them.
So what have you seen, Ashley? What's the process of folks finding their diblings?
So there are several different ways that it can happen. Sometimes meetings between genetic relatives are facilitated by the sperm banks or the fertility clinics that facilitate the sperm donation. Those institutions, they keep track of who's used what sample, and if both parties opt in, you know, the family and the donor, the fertility clinic can connect them. Or I think they sometimes will just connect families who have used the same donor without the donor being connected as well. But other times it's more organic than that. Some families who use sperm donation from a sperm bank will know the number of the mm-hmm. sample that they used, and using that information, you know, such and such donor, donor number, such and such fertility clinic, they can find each other through a lot of different channels, you know, the internet, social media, certain websites like the Donor Sibling Registry. And in the UK, they have the Donor Conception Network. Mm-hmm. Those facilitate people finding each other for finding their genetic relatives who they are related to by sperm donation.
Right. And there are huge forums out there for this. Huge
There really
groups.
Are.
Yeah. Let me bring in the studio now Jordan Namoro. Jordan and her wife used donated sperm to conceive their 3-year-old son and belong to a network of other families who share the same donor. Great to have you, Jordan. Thanks for coming in the studio.
Thank you, Jane. Great to be here.
So at what point did you decide you wanted to find these diblings, these donor siblings, this connection to your sperm donor?
So my son was born in April of 2015, and when we were in the hospital, my wife had a C-section, I was pumped up on adrenaline. I was sitting with him in my arms at 4 or 5 in the morning, and I was watching the sunrise over the Charles River. And all of a sudden, I really had this deep sense of curiosity about the families who had chosen the same donor to conceive of their children. And so really, it was within his first week of life that I thought, you know, what kind of community is out there? Who are these parents? Did we have any similarities with these parents? What are these children like? And how could we potentially connect?
And so what was the process for you? Who facilitated this connection?
So I went through my sperm bank and looked to see if there were other people who had used the same donor. And there's sort of an internal network through the sperm bank through which you can do that. And so I sent an email to one woman who popped up, and she emailed me back almost immediately. And then we proceeded to have an email exchange. She mentioned that there had been a Facebook group created for, at the time, I think it was 8 families. Now it's about 12 families who are connected through sharing the same donor.
So you've identified 12 half-siblings?
There are, I use the term diblings.
Diblings?
Yeah, there are 12 families, mm-hmm. 18 diblings, 12 families.
12 families. And so, to your mind, is this the more the merrier? I mean, if there are 100 diblings out there, is that exciting for you? Is that troubling in any way?
I actually haven't been too consumed or concerned about numbers and volume and quantity. What interests me is really facilitating a real deep sense of intimacy and connection and source of comfort through this network. It's very interesting to me in our Facebook group. We often will share photos of our children. We celebrate the different diblings' birthdays. We have conversations about what it's like to be parents of donor-conceived children. And what's sort of come to life is that we actually have shared values, a shared lens through which we understand the world. And for me personally, I feel like I want to be rooting my child in relationships with people who can provide him a source of comfort and connection throughout his life.
So are these social connections for the parents, or do you include your child, your son, at this point?
So my son's 3. He knows that he does have diblings. He's still kind of creating his own understanding of gender and family structures, and there's a lot of curiosity around that. And he's actually met his diblings. There's a family that lives about an hour north of us with whom we have a really close relationship. There were 6 other dibling families with whom we connected 2 summers ago at a little reunion we hosted in New Hampshire, which was really lovely.
And what do you tell him? Who do you say these people are?
We say that these are your diblings. They they share half of your genetic material.
He says, Mommy,
material.
What's a dibling?
What's a dibling? Well, he knows that he has a donor. And so, you know, he has 2 moms, and many of the other kids in this network also have 2 moms or have queer families or have 1 mom. And so he understands that he has a special relationship with these kids. I'm not sure he really quite computes the mechanics of how that all works, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but he relates to them as special kids.
So practically speaking then, Jordan, how do you see this working? Do you anticipate big family reunions, vacations together? I mean, do you want to keep looking for more diblings? Is this, you know, where you kind of draw the line? Or just kind of practically speaking, how do you view this in the future?
I don't have any real set expectations for how my son will relate to his diblings in the future. I feel like it was important for us to give him access to this information and access to these relationships. And I'd like to let it evolve organically. You know, when I met 6 families back in 2016 in New Hampshire, I happen to have really enjoyed them. I like them a lot. And there's sort of a real sense of camaraderie and connection and closeness and care that we have for each other. So to the extent that we can nurture that in the future, I think will be, you know, a source of love and comfort and joy for him, my son.
Ashley Fetters, is this a story that sounds familiar to you?
It certainly is, absolutely.
And so what generally is the response when couples discover that their children share the same DNA with, well, a dozen or more offspring from the same sperm donor?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, there are, there are just so many different reasons people look for this kind of thing, too. And I think it used to be something people were surprised by and is less so now. Obviously, there's a few reasons people seek this out. One being, like Jordan said, curiosity is just so powerful. And, you know, if you know there are people out there who look or talk or act like you or your child, maybe you'll just want to meet them out of curiosity. Mm-hmm. Another reason is, you know, like, again, like Jordan said, for extra social support and information sharing. Sometimes parents will give other parents a heads up about health conditions or behavior traits that are showing up in their kids. I think it's just also helpful to have, you know, other families in your orbit who've been through what you have with a child who's donor conceived and all of the joys and the challenges that come with that. It certainly, that's a story I've heard before that it's just nice to have other people out there who are rooting mm-hmm. for your kid as much as you are.
Some reactions are not all positive. You've written about a story, a young woman who said she felt like a science experiment when she found out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I think there are certain factors that came into that story that are very particular to the era in which she was conceived through donor sperm. I think people were much more quiet about it and didn't discuss it as openly, which I think, you know, we've learned in the decades, in the past few decades, that can be somewhat harmful to make people feel like the way that they came into the world should be a secret. Obviously, we've sort of moved forward from there. So I think that, you know, that's hopefully something we'll start to hear less and less about.
We're discussing the changing norms around donor sibling networks, diblings, if you will. You can join the conversation. Sperm donors, what do you think? Everyone else, what are the benefits of this? The downsides? A board of calls coming up here. I'll get to you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about children conceived with the same donor sperm finding their half-siblings, their diblings, if you will. Does this sound like a forced family or a gift? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. In the 2010 movie, The Kids Are All Right, the children of a lesbian couple went to track down and form a relationship with their sperm donor, Paul, played by Mark Ruffalo. In this scene, the athletic boy Laser struggles to find a common interest to bond with his father, his genetic father, Paul.
Team thing just got on my nerves after a while. You know, I was like, hey, let's go kick some man. What about you?
I play soccer, basketball, baseball, all the team sort of sports.
Hey, man, I wasn't generally bagging on teams. I mean, teams are great. I'm just weird that way.
I like teams. They're cool.
I'm speaking this hour with Ashley Fetters, staff writer for The Atlantic, and Jordan Namoureau. Her son was conceived with donor sperm. She's now a part of a network of families who share the same donor. Let me bring in now Rosanna Hertz, professor of sociology and women's and gender studies at Wellesley College. She's co-author of Random Families, Genetic Strangers, Sperm Donor Siblings, and the Creation of New Kin. This book will be released tomorrow. Great to have you in the studio, Rosanna.
Terrific to meet you, Jane.
Thank you. So the availability of donated sperm and eggs has made possible an entirely new form of family. What did you hope to reveal in the research for your book?
Well, we wanted to know how people who share the same sperm donor might connect with others and how they began to form and meaningful relationships with one another and what would happen when these relationships moved offline.
So there, as Ashley was saying, there was a time when this was a quieter affair, when sperm donation was not really talked about. You know, the donor could stay anonymous forever. Times have changed quite a bit. Parents are making contact with donor siblings, meeting the diblings, as you're calling them. What are you seeing in this new phenomenon?
In the book, we distinguish different errors in donor-conceived networks based upon the kind of both genetic information available and by the ease of access to that information, so that the first error of donor-conceived networks, which begins in the late 1980s, really the assumption was that you would tell your child that there was a donor that helped conceive you, but that basically no one could meet one another. The second era begins in 1990s with the parents who actually purchased also anonymous sperm donors, and they also did not expect to be able to meet others who shared the same donor. And this changed dramatically after 2003, I'd say about 2000 really, with the internet boom, when people could connect with one another and kids could begin to grow up in an era in which donor siblings would become commonplace. As Jordan points out, the term priority today is really diblings. Mm.
So we're at this interesting intersection of new reproductive technology, social media, and DNA testing kits. I mean, there's so many ways to find your biological roots today. How are most people going about this, Rosanna?
Exactly. So today, in fact, sperm banks actually have registries of their own. There are also third-party registries. And most recently, people are connecting with what gets referred to as the DNA registries, Ancestry.com, 23andMe. People use the term genetic relatives, but in fact, people are strangers. And the question for me becomes, and in this book, how do people turn genetic strangers into some form of kin relationship?
Does it always go well?
I think people are curious. We have in the book no examples of people who really didn't like each other. We have examples, though, of people who we refer to as tourists. They just want to know who the others are who might share their DNA.
What their personality traits are.
Mm-hmm. They want to know what they share in common. They want to know who they are. They want to know where they live. They want to know that they can have access to them in case they need medical information also. But they don't form necessarily any kind of tie beyond, looking at the lay of the land like tourists and deciding, who those people are, and then they leave.
It's interesting, I guess it depends on who you're talking to, but it's a cross between an extended family and an alumni network. I mean, a lot of these people are really connecting for a lot of reasons.
Exactly. It's another form of social networks that are emerging, but in a time in which the American family is thinning in terms of its membership and the branches of the, family tree, as you might think about it, this is an important way in which people can create a new kind of kin relationship based now upon genes or biology instead of sociability.
Jordan Amaro, you use donated sperm to conceive your 3-year-old son. We've talked about it. You belong to this network of families who share the same donor. You were telling me you want to humanize what was a sort of transactional experience. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
Can you tell me more about that?
Sure. So when my wife and I decided to conceive using an anonymous sperm donor from a sperm bank, I picked up the phone, I ordered the sperm, and made, a $725 purchase to my credit card for a vial. And that's a very transactional, business-like experience. And there's a lot of sort of unknowns and mystery that comes with thinking about what's contained in that genetic material that you're receiving. And I'm sort of by nature a relational person. I have an expansive sense of community. I want to build community. So being connected to these dibbling families did add a layer of humanity and a sense of safety and warmth and connectivity to in some ways serve as an antidote to the loneliness.
Safety and warmth.
Yeah.
Because you knew there were others out there who shared your experience.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of mystery in conceiving a child with an anonymous sperm donor and in some ways being in community with other people who made the same choice and chose the same path is reassuring and provides some sense of emotional security.
A lot of calls here. Let's go to Chris first in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My daughter is now 16, and I was from a big Catholic family, and unfortunately I was not able to have any more children, and we sought out to see if my daughter had any siblings, and to date she has 13.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of exciting to meet and correspond with people, and I actually was curious if they had any of the same isms that from the donor, and they did. And one of the people that we spoke with, she sent a picture of her daughter, and I got it, and I showed it to my mom, and I didn't tell her who it was, and she's like, I don't remember Angelina ever being around horses, and I said, well, Mom, that's her sibling.
Yeah.
I mean, they looked
so much alike.
I mean, it was scary, because I always thought she looked like our family, and it was incredible, and I think it's been a great journey, and I always have felt it's just that many more people to love her and be in her life.
Chris, thank you so much for the call. Professor Hertz, in every donor sibling network you profiled, there was a certain degree of fascination with the fact that these kids were raised in different families but had striking physical and even cognitive similarities.
Exactly. And that was the first startling moment for both parents and then particularly the older kids who meet at older ages, because they had no idea that other kids could look so much like themselves. So the first thing that kids do when they connect donor-conceived children in our research is that they talk about they look at each other and they figure out all the shared characteristics from who has the curly hair to who has the blue eyes. And then they turn to what's on the donor profiles, including such things as, I like science like the donor, or I'm involved in the love of a particular sport like the donor or other kinds of things. So it's a startling realization and surprise to suddenly meet kids who are also very close in age to you, who are very much alike you. So people want to find those similarities.
Let me play this CBS News clip. It's from 2016. CBS News followed a sperm donor, Todd Whitehurst, as he meets 8 of the children he fathered through sperm donation, as they all spend a weekend together on Cape Cod. Here is his response when asked if he feels responsible for their lives.
Yeah, I do. The responsibility I feel as an uncle. I realize I'm not their parents, right? Their parents are primarily responsible for them. But if their parents are unable to help them, then I would step in and do what I could. Do you feel love? You want to protect them? You want them to have a happy life?
Important to note here that Whitehurst donated about 400 times over 4 years, which means he could have produced some 9,600 vials of sperm to be sold. He only knows 22 biological children. You know, that clip makes me wonder. I mean, it sounds interesting. We've got extended family. There are connections. We know about health issues, you know, all these social reasons to be connected. But do you stop and wonder about this? I mean, is that troubling to you at all?
I think it's troubling for a number of reasons. There are no national regulations that say that an individual donor can only give X number of vials, or that, more importantly, X number of children can be the product of a particular donor, and then that donor would be taken out of the system. Of course, a donor could go to another bank and donate. But as more and more children begin to meet each other, the other problem becomes, how can you have the kind of intimacy between kids who are genetically half siblings if there is 80 or 100 kids out there? Mm-hmm. So it is troubling, and the banks don't release information at all to either the families or to the donors.
Ashley Fetters, jump back in here. How is this all regulated? Is there a regulatory body that oversees all this?
There is. In the United States, we do have one. It's pretty, I would call it pretty loose. In the United Kingdom, there's much more of a system of oversight that's connected to the federal government there. Here, it's just a little bit more like guidelines. The ASRM, I would call
American Society of Reproductive Medicine.
Uh-huh. Yes, thank you. I would call that like the leading authority or the issuer of guidelines as to how this should all be conducted.
And so then does it come down to donor banks? Are there recommendations or regulations within specific donor banks that physicians or fertility specialists are encouraged to follow?
Yes, I think that's exactly how it works. There are, you know, some banks will have certain regulations as to, like, we don't do anonymous sperm donation here. You know, everyone who donates here has to agree to release at least some level of, like, detail or contact information when the donor offspring turns 18. Or, you know, some places are still perfectly fine to accept anonymous donations that never have to reveal any information about themselves. So I've heard it called the Wild West a little bit in America with the regulation or lack thereof that we have overseeing sperm donation.
Professor Hertz, jump back in here. A bit of the Wild West, is it not?
Very much so. And what Ashley's pointing out is that donors are more likely to become identity released today, meaning that at age 18, a child can meet the donor. But what's not being regulated really is why while there are these guidelines, what we discovered through this research is that none of these banks adhere to these guidelines. And our research comes from about 12 different banks across America. And there are more than what the guidelines say, I think, which is around 10 children. So, and parents are very startled by this, of course.
Mm-hmm. Jordan Namoreau, you cannot be in contact with the sperm donor that you used to father your child until that child is 18, right?
Correct.
Do you anticipate opening that door at some point?
You know, if my son expresses an interest in making contact with the donor, I'm happy to afford him that opportunity. And my wife and I sort of made an intentional, conscious choice to choose a donor who's known as an identity release donor. I don't have any expectations or longings or yearnings personally to meet the donor or for my son to meet him. But certainly if that is of interest to him, I wanted to afford him the possibility.
Let's get Jennifer in here from Lawrence, Massachusetts. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course. Go ahead.
Along the line of what you're all talking about specifically right now is I have a cousin who has two children from a donor experience, and she did connect to siblings. But I'm thinking about how the necessity of understanding ancestry is so important for the next generation relationships. If we're not disclosing and kids don't know where their genetics come from, what is to say, just to like a positive and a negative? The positive is, what if you need a bone marrow transplant? Or you need some sort of health initiative where a sibling or people who have similar DNA can help you out.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is, what if you don't know and you end up dating and procreating with your sibling?
I guess like that guy in the CBS clip, Professor Hertz. I mean, if you've got 9,000 vials of sperm out there that have been sold, chances are. But to Jennifer's point, I mean, Jordan Namoreau, were health conditions, behavior traits, any of that, was that part of the calculus in making your decision?
That actually wasn't part of the calculus in making the decision to use a donor from a sperm bank. I will say it's an added benefit, certainly, to be in connection with our donor sibling families with whom we've shared some information about medical issues that have come up from time to time.
Dave, let's get Dave in here from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you guys today?
Well, go ahead, please.
I have an 18-year-old daughter who is a product of a sperm donor. I had cancer about 20 years ago, so we decided to go with the donor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have not told our child. And it, basically, my wife and I were torn. I was sort of in the favor of doing it. She was not. I'm honoring her wishes. However, at some point in time, do we tell her?
Mm-hmm.
How does she find out? And she's a very well-balanced child, but is it difficult on children when you tell them at such an older age? And granted, in 2000, a lot of this wasn't quite as out or as popular as it is now. So, you know, what do
Dave, thank you. Yeah, no, it's a great call.
Dave, the advice today, as it was in the past, it was to really disclose to children. And children are pretty resilient. You will always be her dad, regardless of whether or not she shares genes with a donor. And the reality is she can find out today on her own by
Ancestry website.
Exactly. So I do hope that you and your wife do decide to give her this information.
Dave, thanks so much for the call. We're discussing parents creating donor sibling networks this hour, and you can join the conversation. Is this confusing for a child or part of their story that needs to be told? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about donor sibling networks in the digital age, and you can join the conversation. Is this all just another manifestation of the changing meaning and face of family in America? Or does it go too far? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Ashley Fetters, who wrote about this for The Atlantic, and with Jordan Namoro, who's part of the Dibbling Network, and with Rosanna Hertz, professor at Wellesley College, whose new book, Random Families, is out tomorrow. Jordan, you heard our last caller, Dave, talking about his experience with his 18-year-old daughter. He hasn't told her that she comes from a donor. How do you feel about sort of this changing face of families?
I think it's really interesting. I mean, as a lesbian woman, you know, my wife and I didn't have any set norms or a roadmap for how to create a family. There were a series of options. And many of the families with whom we are connected in our Dibbling network are also queer families or single moms. And I think there's a shared vulnerability that we have in connecting with each other. And we also don't have the luxury to hide information from our child because, you know, we weren't able to create a child in a heteronormative way. And so I think sort of by nature of having a family structure that is unique, we are giving our child this access and information because it's part of his origin story.
Let's get Chris in here from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have an interesting story around this. I'm 38 years old, and a year and a half ago, my parents told me that they had used a... So I grew up in a very nuclear family in the Midwest, and... year and a half ago, they told me that they had used a, had trouble conceiving and used a sperm donor. And it was absolutely the most shocking moment of my life. I have a wonderful relationship with my dad and had always kind of, you know, identified myself as part of him. So it was an interesting kind of thing to process. It really reaffirmed my belief that family's family, no matter what, and it really doesn't matter. But I have, over the past year and a half, found my genetic father. He has nine children that he had with his wife. And then we also found two other twins that are also my half-siblings, as well as a half-cousin.
How did you find them, Chris? How did you all connect?
So I found him on Ancestry. He actually didn't have an active account, but his sister, who is very into genetics and Ancestry, had uploaded his DNA. And then I had also done 23andMe, and that's where I had found my my cousin, and since then my half-brother is on there, too.
Wow. Chris, thank you so much. I mean, would you say, Professor Hertz, it's almost guaranteed that if you want to find your donor, you will if you try hard enough.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, you can't think about anonymity any longer as a way in which to mask donor conception. And so in many ways, it's a good thing that people are sharing the information, as Jordan's talking about, with younger children. So it becomes part of what we discuss in the book as birth narratives and how people present to kids how they came to be in the world.
So years ago, there was this fragile barrier, as we've talked about, that existed between the sperm banks and donors when it came to confidentiality. And now, I mean, I guess the sperm banks have to confront that head on.
Yes, exactly. But in the early days, parents who had fertility problems went to their doctors who provided fresh sperm through medical schools. That's really changed a lot as commercial banks, for various reasons, have emerged. So the kind of story that the caller who just called in was talking about is becoming more unlikely. Particularly as we begin to celebrate our origins and disclosure and different kinds of families emerge and there's greater diversity and understanding between us.
Let's get Dana in here from Farmville, Virginia. Hi, Dana. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I've been listening to you and very interested in the topic. In the 80s, I was a part of, I was a significant other in a relationship. And my partner had two donor children from a, as you said, a fresh sperm bank from a medical student. But we knew no information other than of the request of color of hair, eye color, and healthy. And then they're now 30 and 28. In 2004, I used the California Cryo Bank and had a child of my own, and the amount of information on the donor was so significantly different. You know, background, you know, information on health, education, all of that. And through the DonorSiblingsRegistry.com, there's been eight of us who have connected from the East Coast to the West Coast, and the kids and parents started meeting each other at the age of two. And then last summer, wasn't the first summer, but last summer, 13 of us, including six of the boys, rented a house together. And, you know, over the years, we have vacationed together or met each other. Like, I'm out on the West Coast, I'll meet a couple of the boys and the families. And I think the relationships of the boys who knew each other since the age of two, now they're 14, is very different than my older children who are just finding it out through like 23andMe.
Well, that's interesting. Right. Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you. Also, because what you point out is that the various different errors that have occurred in our understanding of donor-conceived networks and also how the information we're given has changed a lot. I think what's important that we haven't talked about is how the kids who meet then form close ties with one another. And even though they may be raised in different households and have different moms and dads, or two moms or one mom, the kids then form their own relationships with one another, and that's really interesting to watch because what they are doing is extending kinship to in unscripted ways to these to their donor siblings who they've just met in the last 10 years or so.
Ashley Fetters, how do you see these relationships evolving?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, one thing that that Dr. Hertz found in her book that I thought was just absolutely fascinating was that some of these more recently formed networks, parents have like additional motives for, you know, for joining these networks. And these parents, I think, told Dr. Hertz that what they see the networks as is sort of these underground networks for opportunities and advantages they might not otherwise have. So it's a different, you know, it's certainly a different view of what family works for and what we what we rely on our relatives for.
You mean like later in life, I don't know, looking for a job or finding a place to stay when you're visiting Chicago or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, precisely.
Right. Thank you, Ashley, for the wonderful piece that you wrote about the, what we call the social capitalists in the book. And these are basically, we argue that parents believe that joining was important early on because kids could benefit from the opportunities that they imagine will come their way as the kids become older, and that they're creating memories for their children, not unlike cousins would have with one another. And then later on in life, you can pull on these relationships in new ways, or maybe there'll be a bed for a family member in Australia, but there you would have relatives cross the world, in effect.
Is that how you hope for? Is that what you see, Jordan, in your three-year-old's future?
Yeah, I do. I mean, our dibbling network is extremely geographically diverse. We have dibbling families in Australia, in England, Arizona, California. And I do feel like, you know, the world is increasingly lonely and isolated and alienating for kids, to, you know, as they mature and as they enter their formative years. And I feel like to the extent that this network can be an antidote to that loneliness and offer him you know, opportunities for connection and advancement, I think that can only be a strength.
Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Lori is waiting on the line. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thank you. This is a great program. And I am married to a woman, and our son was born in 2002. And he's an only child. And we found out 3 years ago because we registered on the California Cryobank that he has a sister in New York City. And so we have met her and her single mom, and we connected in the first moment, and the two of them you could tell instantly that they are brother and sister. And it has just been amazing to watch my son have this relationship with her. I can see how he's just sort of like more comfortable in his skin, if you will, sort of out in the world, like knowing that he has a half-sister. So that has been really nice to see. And his sister is incredibly outgoing, and she actually has connected in the past year or so, has found six other half-siblings, and in 3 weeks we're all going to be meeting in New York City, and my son will be meeting his half-brother, who is 2 years younger than him, and of course his other siblings. So for our family, it's been just incredible to have this experience and for him to have this connection with his sister. And consequently, his sister has been able to, through Ancestry.com, find the donor father.
Interesting.
Lori,
thank you. I'm going to jump in. Professor Hertz, I know you want to speak here.
Lori, it's just very exciting to know that your child that your only child is going to meet all of his half-siblings shortly. The kids that we meet talk about how these are both friendships as well as relatives, and that magical moment of meeting and trying to transform these strangers into family is very exciting. Kids talk about how they have one another's backs in a way that even friendships in schools do not, and how they accept each other despite very different activities and interests and everything else. So I wish you good luck with that first meeting.
Lori, thanks so much for the call. Here's a clip. Courtney McKinney was 16 years old. She learned that she had been conceived through an anonymous sperm donor. Over the years, she's tried to reach out to her donor, but he refuses contact. She has made contact, though, with a half-sister. And here she tells StoryCorps about meeting her dibbling, Alexandra Sanchez, for the first time at the age of 28.
I always wished for siblings. That's the one thing I always dreamt of. And so when we actually met for the very first time, when you ran up and hugged me, just the feeling, the intense feelings inside, I just knew. We went to go have lunch. And remember, there was like these two guys sitting next to our table, totally eavesdropping. I swear one of them even like pushed his chair over so he could hear us. I remember thinking, this is the first time I get to have a beer with my sister. I grew up thinking that I looked exactly like my mother until I met you. I remember us looking at each other and saying, oh, you have freckles.
Yeah.
And of course, the smile and the way our chins curve. I remember getting in the car and my husband said, I have a sister-in-law. And I was thinking, could this all be true?
I just look forward to
learning how to be a sister. It's such a weird thing to do at 28 years old. It's something we both have a learning to do in. We didn't get to grow up together, but we will get to grow old together.
From StoryCorps. Let's go back to the phones. Nicole in Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. This is such a fascinating conversation, especially being the parent of a donor-conceived kid. So we have about 14 kids in our donor sibling family from all over the U.S., and we have gotten together three different times, and it feels like they are extended family. Mm. And the kids are just instantly best friends. We all get along fantastic. So we decided to jump in and just embrace her story. And because it's unique, it's different, and we kind of wanted to normalize it for her so that she can continue these relationships as she gets older if she mm-hmm. chooses to.
Nicole, thank you very much for the call. I have to get this question in from our website, Professor Hertz. Is the donor free and clear of liabilities? What about paternity suits at some point?
Because donors our identity release and those who come forward do so at age 18, that's exactly why they are free from liability. Those who come forward earlier on and they reveal their identities on also these various sites really could be liable, but I know of no cases, legal cases, in which that's been the case. Mostly, families would like to know the donor, but I have to say this. Among the donor siblings that were interviewed in our book, not everybody is interested in meeting these donors. They do talk about how their donor siblings are actually more important to them. In about a third of the kids that we interviewed would like to meet the donor. Mm-hmm. A third really are very ambivalent, and a third are just really totally not interested.
Right.
So it's not like everyone really – the focus, I think, is no longer on donors and more on the donor siblings and what the opportunities they offer for creating new forms of kinship, as Courtney and several other people have talked about.
Jordan Namoro, do you have expectations for your son, for your three-year-old, for his future with his siblings, about what he expects from those relationships?
I don't have expectations. I think I have a desire and a hope that he will find a source of comfort and camaraderie in nurturing those relationships. And I was reflecting on what the caller had shared a few minutes ago, that when we had a dibbling reunion, our first one in New Hampshire a couple of years ago, it was amazing to see even these toddlers showing affection for each other, caring for each other. And there was a tremendous amount of fluidity in terms of how the parents related to the different kids. I woke up early one morning. I made French toast with a four-year-old while another parent was holding my kid and reading him a story. And so there is that nurturance that I think is really beautiful.
Jordan Namoro, part of a dibbling network. Great to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
Ashley Fetters, staff writer for The Atlantic. Ashley, thank you so much for your piece and for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Jane.
And Rosanna Hertz, professor of sociology and women's and gender studies at Wellesley College. Her new book, Random Families, Genetic Strangers, Sperm Donor Siblings, and the Creation of New Kin. That's out tomorrow. Professor Hertz, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Terrific to meet you, Jane.
Thank you. Listeners, thanks for your calls. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.